This is Friday on the Other Side on Mind Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Fridays, we take a look at experiences and concepts that you might not think have a mental health component, but in fact, they do.
And I'd like to introduce you to today's guest. His name is Dr. Jeff Borenstein, and he is the CEO and president of the Brain and Behavior Research Foundation, editor-in-chief of Psychiatric News, he wears lots of hats, which is the newspaper of the American Psychiatric Association, and he's was also a part of the editorial advisory group for a brand new consumer guide, which I have to say that I would recommend everybody listening pick up a copy of, Understanding Mental Disorders, Your Guide to DSM-5. Dr. Jeff Borenstein, welcome to Mind Talk.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with some explanations. The title of this book is Understanding Mental Disorders, Your Guide to the DSM-5. For those listening who have no idea what the DSM-5 is, let's start there.
Sounds good. And the purpose of this book really goes to what you did with the lead into the show, which is mental health literacy.
Mm-hmm.
So the purpose of this guidebook is for lay people, for people who may have a psychiatric condition, their family members, for lay professionals such as teachers and clergy and others, to be able to have better mental health literacy. The DSM-5 is the guidebook that is used by psychiatrists and other mental health professionals to help us in the diagnosis of various psychiatric conditions. And that guidebook was written over the course of a number of years with input from top experts in the field. And the guidebook actually was published 2 years ago, and we felt that it made sense to have a version of it that is written specifically for the lay public.
And I think that this is the first time that you've actually done that. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct.
Okay.
This is the first time that we've written a guidebook like this about the diagnostic manual geared specifically to lay people.
Now, you know, as you know, with anything else, there's controversy around pretty much everything on the planet, and the DSM-5 is no stranger to some controversy. But with each iteration of the DSM, there have been changes, and what I'm wondering from you is what your thoughts are about this current version of the DSM-5. Are you comfortable with the information that is given? Do you have any concerns? Is there another version on the way?
Good question. As is the case with really all areas of medicine, we are constantly learning more, and learning more helps us do a better job diagnostically and do a better job in terms of treatment and ultimately prevention. So DSM-5 is based upon the latest scientific knowledge. So it really is the most cutting-edge guidebook that we have in terms of psychiatric diagnosis. That being said, research is continuing.
Mm-hmm.
Learning more is continuing. One of the hats that I wear is I serve as the CEO and president of the Brain and Behavior Research Foundation. Our foundation is the largest private funder of research grants in psychiatry. So the research continually brings new information forward that is useful to patients and their clinicians. So there's constantly a development of new information, but the current DSM-5 really is the most up-to-date guidebook available.
Now, the idea of actually bringing to the public a way of understanding mental health, wellness, and disorders. Certainly, there was a time when you might go to your doctor for information and for help, and he or she may have told you what your diagnosis is and may not have. There, I would dare say, there are actually some clinicians who, at least at a time, were actually kind of annoyed if you asked them what your diagnosis was and what that meant. But there really seems to be a huge shift and a huge appreciation for the need for the lay public, if you will, to have a full awareness of what their diagnoses are, what it means, what it doesn't mean, and what treatment options are.
I think you're right on target with the way that things have progressed. And there was a time where people went to their doctor and just sort of tell me what to do and I'll do it and that's it, in all areas of medicine.
Yes.
And I think that now people are much more aware, access to information is much easier with the internet. And I think just the culture of our society is to be knowledgeable, and we often throw the word empower around, mm-hmm. but in this case, I think knowledge really does empower a patient and his or her family. So it's very important for people to understand what these diagnoses are, what the symptoms are as they relate to the diagnosis. And I think shows such as yours, which has a tremendous following, is just an example of the hunger that's out there for this kind of information.
Absolutely. And in fact, I take this directly from Understanding Mental Disorders, as I quote, more than 450 million people worldwide, 450 million people worldwide. That is a huge number. And over 61 million adults and over 7 million children in the United States live with a mental disorder at some point in your life. So this quote actually says two things, actually maybe three things, at least to me, and I'd like to get your take on it. Certainly it says that mental health is something that impacts all of us, no matter where we live, no matter what we look like, no matter what we believe. When we say that 450 million people worldwide have a mental disorder at some point,
I know you have a few points. Let me jump to that one, and then you'll make the others. I'll respond mm-hmm. to those. I think that for many years, due to embarrassment, what's often referred to as stigma, and we could talk a little bit more about stigma as our conversation continues, people really were hesitant to acknowledge that they might have had a psychiatric condition, mm-hmm. and just as importantly, to seek out help, and would often suffer in silence.
Indeed.
And the magnitude of these issues across the board is tremendous. And in many ways, why should it be a surprise to us that an organ as complicated as the brain will sometimes be off a little bit?
True. You're absolutely right.
We're not surprised. We almost expect that over the course of a lifetime, a person will develop a medical condition, whether it be heart disease or cancer or some other medical condition. We almost expect that. We don't want it, but we expect it.
Right.
And why should the organ that relates to our emotions and our thought processes, the brain, why would that organ not be any more susceptible to illness than any other organ? It's a part of the body. So I think that the point you made is extremely important, and everybody is touched by this. Everyone has a family member, close friend, someone important to them, right, who have experienced one of these conditions. So we all are impacted by it. And these conditions really don't know boundaries, whether it be boundaries of nations, whether it be boundaries of socioeconomic status, ethnic, religious. These conditions affect all of us.
You know, the other piece that this quote sort of says to me, the quote that I just shared, when I quote you guys as saying 61 million adults and over 7 million children just in the United States alone, a lot of times, first of all, those are huge numbers for the United States, but also the idea that so many children are affected, are impacted upon. You know, so many times, how many times have we heard adults say, you know, I wish I were a kid again. All I had to do was to eat, sleep, and go to school. And, you know, there's no, for many people, there's not a real awareness or appreciation that many, many children have some challenges themselves that might require some mental health intervention.
Absolutely. And in many of these conditions actually develop during childhood, adolescence, and young adulthood. So many of the psychiatric conditions first appear during this time, whether it be major depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, chemical dependency, certainly attention deficit disorder. Obviously, autism is a disorder of childhood, but many of these brain disorders, psychiatric disorders, really begin in youth. And to me, one of the most important statistics, one of the greatest challenges for all of us, is the fact that we lose too many children, adolescents, young adults, to suicide. And after accidents, suicide is the largest cause of death in young people. And that is a tragedy that we all need to work towards preventing.
Absolutely.
And the most important thing to prevent it is diagnosis and treatment.
I want to go back to the issue of children in a moment, but the third and sort of final piece I'd like to draw from the earlier quote that I shared was when you say that folks live with a mental health disorder at some point in their lives. And the reason I'd like to underscore that is because so many times we hear, if you've had a mental illness yesterday, that means for the rest of your life, you are forever impaired and people need to shy away from you. Now, I don't think it's that bad today as it was perhaps, you know, several years ago, but that is still an issue for folks. And so when you say at some point in their lives, it suggests that you can have a mental illness, that you can recover, and that this is not necessarily a lifetime experience.
That is such an important point, that people can have a psychiatric condition and receive treatment and be better. And sometimes they may require ongoing treatment to maintain their health. And sometimes it's a period of time, they have the treatment, and then they're fine. So the important point is that people shouldn't just accept whether let's, for example, being depressed, having a major depression, what's often referred to as a clinical depression. People shouldn't just accept that and sort of grin and bear it, keep a stiff upper lip, whatever terms that are used. People should seek help for that. And that's an important message that we need to continually remind people about.
Dr. Jeff Borenstein, as you have heard, the CEO and president of the Brain and Behavior Research Foundation, editor-in-chief of Psychiatric News, which is the newspaper of the American Psychiatric Association, and he was also part of the editorial advisory group for the consumer guide that we are discussing today. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to go back to some of those diagnoses that you mentioned a few moments ago. Because they are diagnoses that often scare people. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We'll be back in a moment. Jeff, as you were identifying some of the diagnoses that may show up in childhood, with each one that you mentioned, I could almost see some parent somewhere almost cringing in fear and self-recriminations that somehow it's their fault that their child is struggling with major depression, bipolar disorder, attention deficit, autism, schizophrenia. I mean, you name the ones that really kind of send people over the edge with fear and anxiety. If you believe that your child is struggling with any of these things, do you automatically then have to think that it's your fault and it's your shame as a parent?
Very important question. You know, parents obviously are concerned about their children, love their children, want the best for their children. And when anything isn't exactly ideal, often they blame themselves. Mm-hmm. And the same is true for all of the conditions that you just mentioned. The reality is these conditions are not the result of bad parenting. These conditions are not the result of something that a parent did wrong. So it's important for people to, and you're asking the question was extremely useful because it's important for people to realize that developing these conditions aren't the fault of any individual. Mm. People who have the condition, it's not their fault. And people who are the parents of a person with the condition, it's not their fault. And I think that that's something that needs to be emphasized over and over again.
Well, and you know, there was a time, certainly, I mean, I remember back in the days when I was in school, which of course was just a minute ago, that mm-hmm. when we talked about schizophrenia, we also talked about the mother. And it was somehow, it was the schizophrenic mother's fault creation if the child was schizophrenic. And there was a lot of stuff that was either connected to the woman because she was a woman, not so much the man to the child. You know, there were certainly inferences drawn based on race and gender and all kinds of stuff that were then and are not now in the same way. And I think people sometimes forget about the fact that things have changed and we no longer have, you know, those kinds of same narrow and limiting views of health and certainly mental health and mental wellness.
Your point is exactly correct, that there was a time where there was reference to what was called then a schizophrenogenic mother, mm-hmm. saying that a certain type of mothering style can result in this illness. And part of why it's so important that we write this guidebook for the lay public is to dispel those kind of notions and to really let people know what the current scientific basis is for these conditions. And certainly the idea that a person develops schizophrenia as a result of bad parenting, whether it be the mother or father, that has gone by the wayside. That doesn't exist by any stretch of the imagination at this point. And it's important for people to realize that. And that's part of why having that knowledge in hand, it's so helpful for families.
Absolutely. Now, I notice with this guidebook, it's referred to as a manual of warning signs and treatment plans, which I was kind of struck by because I don't think I've ever really thought of the DSM, any of the iterations in that way. But, you know, it's an interesting frame to put on certainly the consumer edition, a manual of warning signs and treatment plans.
Well, we wanted people to not only see the scientific basis for the different diagnoses that exist, but also to see what are the key approaches to treatment for these diagnoses. We also include in the book vignettes that are based on real life stories of people who have had these conditions. We obviously change the name, you know, maintain confidentiality. Because often, you know, the saying a picture is worth a thousand words, sometimes the personal story brings home a message that's very meaningful for people. And some of the feedback that I've received about the book is that the combination of the scientific facts right there in black and white and in an easy-to-read fashion, along with these clinical vignettes, really brings home for that person, oh, this sounds like me.
Right.
This sounds like my loved one. It's a way for people to really get a hold of this information.
And, you know, I think in a lot of ways, the vignettes, I think, are really important. I mean, in many ways, the conversations that I do here at Mind Talk are about vignettes. They're about people's lives. And you know, I think it's a gentler, more compassionate, in a lot of ways, more tolerable and more inclusive way to give people the information that is so important. And so, again, I just think that this guide is wonderful for everyone to have, clinician and non-clinician, in their home, because it's helpful. You know, it helps us to understand what's going on and when it might be time to seek out some additional help. I also noticed that in the appendices, you folks list helpful resources that go beyond the American Psychiatric Organization, American Psychiatric Foundation. So again, it really is something that is written, I think, for the general consumer to be able to pick up and to be guided by.
I agree with you. And, people do not recover in a vacuum.
Right.
So certainly having a good treatment team, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, nurses, etc., a team of professionals is important. Having a supportive family whenever that's possible is important. But then there are other areas that are available for support, and we list some of those additional resources that make a tremendous difference for people in recovery.
Let's talk about some of the specific diagnoses that perhaps the names have changed or the conceptualization of them has changed over time. Folks aren't diagnosed with hypochondriasis anymore. It's now illness anxiety disorder. Talk about the illness anxiety disorder. What does that mean?
Yeah, I think, you know, in many ways, one of the important areas of scientific growth in our understanding is in the area of anxiety disorders.
Mm. Okay.
And in the DSM-5, we're really able to bring to bear some of the new information that's based upon clinical experience, research studies, better understanding of the mechanisms of the brain that put into a better perspective where various anxiety disorders exist.
Mm-hmm.
And, from my perspective, I think that in the past, anxiety disorders might not have received enough attention.
Yeah.
People, okay, you're anxious, get over it.
Yeah, so what?
But we now recognize that anxiety disorders and or anxiety in the context of some other disorder, so anxiety in the context of depression,
mm-hmm.
Can be extra debilitating, can be a greater risk of, God forbid, a suicide attempt.
Yeah.
So there, I think, is a much better understanding across the board of various anxiety disorders.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think that at one point, if you were anxious, you were either a woman or you might as well have been. And it was just kind of dismissed. You're right. Just get over it and get yourself together. And now there is in fact, a much broader understanding of it. Talk about, again, specifically illness anxiety disorder. What does that mean? Does that mean that I'm worried about being sick or that I'm sick a lot? Or what is that? Do I make it up? What does that actually mean?
It can, I think that there are various levels to it, but it can mean that the person's anxiety about becoming ill can become overwhelming for the person themselves.
Okay.
So that that the anxiety overwhelms the situation, and that's where the person can have some difficulty.
Okay. There's another experience that's certainly in the media, I think, a great deal today, more so than perhaps in years past. At least that's my perspective. And that is autism. From where I sit, it's all over the media in lots of different ways, but I'm not sure that people really understand what it is. Can you speak to that?
Yes. Autism has been in the media and has received a lot of attention, and it's important that it does. And autism is a developmental disorder. It can begin to show itself in early childhood, and it's not one disorder. People are not all the same who have autism, and that's why there's a reference to being on a spectrum of the disorder, where different people have different abilities, different people may have different areas of disability. And one of the concerns with DSM-5 was that because there were some changes in how the autism spectrum was characterized, that some people would potentially no longer have the diagnosis, and that would block them from getting the important treatment and services that they need.
Yes.
And one of the, and this was an important concern that people had, that if that were the case, it could be a problem. But a lot of work was done into looking at how the current criteria for the autism spectrum disorders would relate to prior criteria, and the findings were that really people would not lose out on the needed treatment and benefits that are required. This is a condition that when diagnosed early and when interventions are put in place early, it makes a tremendous difference in the life of the child. So, and it's extremely important that those early diagnoses be made, and just as important that treatment and services be available for that child.
For the child and for the family as well. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue with Dr. Jeffrey Bornstein as we discuss Understanding Mental Disorders, Your Guide to the DSM-5. Don't go away. Dr. Bornstein, we've been talking about Understanding Mental Disorders, Your Guide to the DSM-5, and I'm not sure if we actually explained what DSM means. We may have, but let me just say Diagnostic Statistical Manual. And 5, this is the fifth, it's not the fifth edition, but it's because we've had versions in between. But how does this actually get used by your clinician and insurance companies?
Very good question. And yes, it's officially the fifth edition, but there were some sort of subset editions.
Right.
in between. But this is the most up-to-date. And it really is a guidebook so that when a clinician is seeing a patient and making a determination as to whether or not they have a major depression or bipolar disorder, the criteria that exist to make those diagnoses are in the book.
Okay.
And that is the most cutting-edge information in terms of making a diagnosis. So it's important for clinicians, and it is also important because sometimes one of the biggest challenges for patients and their families is making sure that they have access to care.
Yeah.
And part of the benefit of this guidebook for consumers is that having that information, if there is a disagreement between the physician and the insurance company, between the patient and the insurance company, as to whether or not they meet the criteria and therefore the insurance will pay for the services, having this information in hand is a very powerful tool.
Yes.
For the patient and family, because they have the same criteria as the insurance company has, and they could say, wait a second here, we do meet this criteria.
Yeah.
Because we have X, Y, and Z.
And I think the other usefulness is in really understanding what the clinician is saying when they tell you what your diagnosis is. You know, so many times people get a diagnosis and they get so caught up in anxiety about what that means that they may not even hear, quite frankly, what the clinician is really saying has brought them to the decision that this diagnosis versus another is the one that's accurate for the individual. So having this manual allows you to go back when you're perhaps not in the clinician's office and read through it. And if you've got some questions yourself about how the diagnosis was made, you can bring them up to the diagnosing clinician. Would you agree that that's a reasonable use as well?
A very important use.
Okay.
If somebody, let's say they are in an evaluation and the diagnosis is told to them, person is going to be anxious, is going to be worried, isn't going to be able to take everything in. And they can then go home and read about it, see what questions they have, and then go back to the next appointment with the clinician and say, I was looking at this. How does this fit into what I have?
Absolutely.
So it's a very powerful tool for people.
And for those folks, I say this a lot, I know, but I don't think it can be said too often. For those folks who grew up in a time or have a belief that you don't question, quote unquote, authority, or you don't question experts, it really is important to question. If you've got a good quality expert sitting in front of you, they embrace the questions and they're going to give you the information, the best information that they have. It is not only okay to question, it's actually important to question. I think a lot of people just take the information in and just sort of sit with it and don't know what to do with it.
It is extremely important to question. It is extremely important for people to understand these issues. And sometimes, even with an excellent clinician, it may make sense to get a second opinion.
Absolutely.
And a good clinician would embrace their patient getting a second opinion. It's not
absolutely.
In any way disrespectful or negative. It's sometimes, especially if things aren't moving forward as one would hope, a second opinion can be extremely helpful.
Absolutely. I think when it gets to the fifth and sixth and 12th opinion that you've got something else going on. But absolutely getting a second opinion is always very valuable. Let's just go back to autism spectrum disorder again, because we talked around it, but we didn't give the listeners a sense of what that might actually look like with a child. Can you give us just a brief glance of what a child might behave as with this kind of a diagnosis?
Yeah, again, there is variability. So
sure.
Different children will have different types of symptoms, but often there could be some difficulty in terms of interpersonal interactions.
Mm-hmm.
So the child may not interact with other children, with their other family members, in a way that a typically developing child would. Sometimes they become very focused on particular areas of interest that take up a lot of their time and a lot of their focus. The parents know that there's something wrong.
Yeah.
And often it's the pediatrician that they discuss it with. And I think the most important advice for parents is that if you think there may be something wrong, if you have a question, you really should bring this up with the pediatrician.
Absolutely.
And not just leave it be, but bring it up and say, I'm noticing this, this, and this. I would have, from seeing other children, from, just my own general sense, I feel like there might be something that isn't the way it should be. And don't be shy about bringing it up with the pediatrician and then perhaps going for an evaluation with somebody who has expertise in autism.
Let me ask you one more question about about a diagnosis that typically shows up with children, and that is social communication disorder. That, I believe, is a new diagnosis in the DSM-5.
Yes, I believe that you're correct about that. I believe that that's correct.
And so what exactly is a social communication disorder? What does that look like in a 4 or 5-year-old child?
I'm going to have to defer on that question because it's not my area of expertise.
Okay.
So I don't have that right in front of me.
Okay.
So I'm going to defer on that one.
All right. One of the things, though, that I think is important is, I just asked you about a 4 or 5-year-old child. There are times when you can see things that show up in your children and they really are younger than a parent thinks a child can reasonably experience something that's difficult. So I want to make sure that parents don't say, well, my child is only 2 years old. It can't possibly be anything. He or she will grow out of it.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there is a balance that we want to strike of not being alarmist.
Right.
You know, parents are just naturally, appropriately worried to begin with. If they have a question or a doubt, to seek help. And certainly if a child has experienced a trauma, and that would be something to really make sure that the pediatrician is aware of it, and that if there are changes in behavior, that there be an evaluation. And the trauma could be physical abuse, could be emotional abuse,
right.
Could be sexual abuse, it could be loss of a parent or a sibling. So there are, you know, a variety of ways that children can experience trauma. And if they do, that certainly is a reason for them to receive an evaluation.
Absolutely. The diagnosis of gender dysphoria, talk about what that means and some of the history, if you would, around that diagnosis.
The, there was a time where, again, mistakenly, and science has proven mm-hmm. that it was a mistake, that people's sexual orientation would be a diagnosis, so
right.
that homosexuality was a diagnosis in a much earlier version of the diagnostic manual.
Yeah.
And science really has moved forward from that to demonstrate that that's not the case. We've really moved forward scientifically, and I think wonderfully as a society.
Yeah, I think you're right.
To reduce the prejudice that's existed for people based on their sexual orientation. That's been a tremendous move forward for society. And I think that we are now seeing, with some of the recent publicity in the press, about transgender issues being really people looking at it, society looking at it, in a more open way and in a more understanding way.
Yeah, I think
so
there's a lot more.
I think that's a step forward.
Absolutely. I think there's a lot more compassion and certainly a lot less blaming and shaming about those kinds of issues, those kinds of experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, just to broaden it, I alluded to it earlier in terms of the overall stigma that exists for psychiatric conditions. I think in many ways, stigma is too soft of a term.
Mm.
I think that it really is prejudice.
Interesting.
And that there
yeah.
still is an acceptance. It's not as bad as it was, but there still is an acceptance of prejudice based on the fact that somebody may have a psychiatric condition. And fortunately in our society, while it still exists, we no longer accept prejudice based on gender and sexual orientation and race and religion. It still exists, but it's not accepted. And I think that there's still too many people that accept it in the area of mental health. And we need to do everything possible to stop that, because it is prejudice, and that needs to end.
You know, I think I agree with you, but if we were to have a conversation about prejudice, we'd be talking for about another 10 or 12 months nonstop. Because
absolutely.
It is so much a part of our society in so many ways that are overt and covert. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I just want to share with the audience a brief snippet of what social communication disorder is defined as in this guidebook. And then I've got more questions for you, Dr. Borenstein. So we'll be right back,
okay.
folks.
Great.
Dr. Borenstein, you'd indicated that the diagnosis of social communication disorder, which is also looks like it's identified as pragmatic communication disorder, is not really your area of expertise. I just wanted to share a little bit from Understanding Mental Disorders, your guide to DSM-5, with the audience, and also gives you a sense of just how plainly and clearly written the book actually is. It is identified as a new diagnosis, and it involves problems in the social use of verbal and nonverbal communication. Problems can be seen by age 4 or 5. Milder forms may not be known until the early teens, when social communication becomes more complex. One of the things that may show up in this kind of disorder is trouble understanding humor, figures of speech, what is not stated, and words that might have different meanings in other settings. I share that with the audience because it is something that I did bring up in our conversation, but also, so I wanted to give them a sense of what I was actually talking about, but also to give you sort of a bird's eye listen to the way in which this manual is reading, is written. I mean, it really is written for the general public. I think it's valuable for students of who are going through training as clinicians, but it's also absolutely readable for the everyday person who needs to have this information. One of the, was there anything you wanted to say about that, Dr. Borenstein?
I just want to add to, in terms of individuals who could benefit from this information, I think that, and I mentioned it earlier, my wife is a teacher, and so her husband's a psychiatrist, and she can come home and tell me about a student that she has a concern about, and you know, we could talk about it. The teachers are very much a first line of defense.
Yes.
And I think this book is extremely, extremely useful for teachers to have, for coaches to have. And also, when people have trouble, they often go to clergy. And I think that
Absolutely.
This is a very useful book for members of clergy to have as well, so that they have this information in hand and can help people who come to them with a variety of issues.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. So many times teachers see what perhaps parents don't see, or teachers may have a tolerance for seeing it in a way that parents may not be able to tolerate. Again, that's a whole other conversation, but I absolutely agree with you. Teachers, clergy, coaches, I think it's a document. I really do think it's a manual written for everybody. Let's talk about treatment options. As I look at the book, as it's been put together, not only do you have what the signs and symptoms could look like, because with the information that you gather in this book, you then want to go to your clinician or professional to get more information. And not only does it have the signs and symptoms that could be evidenced with a particular issue, but it's also got the vignettes, as we talked about earlier, and it also has treatment essentials. So let's talk about what that means, because again, treatment for some folks is kind of scary because they don't know what to expect. Let's talk about what happens when you decide that treatment is something that's important to you. Is there a first place you should go? Is there a first step you should take?
Yes, and I would say that as a part of determining whether or not a person needs treatment, it makes sense to see a mental health professional.
Okay.
Whether it be a psychiatrist, a psychologist, a social worker, but it makes sense to see a mental health professional. And once you've seen a professional, and together, based on information you provide, based on a careful mental status exam, which is where they're asking you various questions, based on a history, let's say a diagnosis is made. Let's say that diagnosis is major depression, clinical depression. At that point, having that diagnosis, it makes sense to have treatment.
Okay.
And treatment may consist of talk therapy, and they consist of medication, antidepressant medication. They consist of a combination of both of those. But the important thing is that together with the clinician who made the diagnosis, the person determines what the course of treatment will be. Those are the steps.
You know that there are some people for whom the idea of taking a pill for anything is just a hideous, inconceivable thought, and they just won't do it. Do you have anything you want to say to those folks?
Well, I think that, you know, certainly there are people who don't want to take a pill for anything. I think the important message, and the pill often isn't the pill. The pill may be talk therapy.
So, gotcha.
You know, they may not want either type of a quote-unquote pill. And it may not be just for a depression. It may be for high blood pressure, or it may be for some other medical condition.
Right.
So I think the important thing and part of the benefit of this guidebook is really to educate the person so that they could understand that the condition that they're experiencing is a real condition. It's not based upon moral weakness or a character flaw. It's not based upon not trying their best, but it's based upon a real illness, a real condition that's treatable. And encouraging people to sort of take that perspective, and then it's helpful if somebody really is suffering, if somebody has a depression and it's affecting their ability to function in school or at work, it's having them have feelings of wanting to harm themselves. If they're not eating, so they're losing weight, they're not sleeping, a variety of symptoms, I think it's important for the clinician, for the person's loved ones, to point out to them that these are all things that could get better with appropriate treatment, and really encourage them.
Now, as we talk about treatment, there are a couple of treatments that are mentioned in this guidebook that, you know, I would suggest are perhaps somewhat controversial, perhaps one more than the other. ECT, electroconvulsive therapy. Certainly that was very popular for a time. It fell out of favor, and now it is back in, but it still scares some folks. What exactly is electroconvulsive therapy? What is ECT?
Yeah, ECT is used most frequently to treat depression, and by having electrical currents go to the brain, it actually can bring about seizure-type activity in the brain, and having a number of the treatments with ECT can lift a depression. Now, it is an invasive procedure because you're taking those steps, but sometimes it can be a life-saving procedure for certain people. The part of why it isn't used as much now as it had been in the past is that we have more options from a medication standpoint to treat depression.
Okay.
So there are more options available before going to ECT. But sometimes for people who aren't able to tolerate the medicines, who may be at an acute risk of harming themselves, who may be starving because their appetite is so low that they're just not eating, ECT can be life-saving. So it's something that we have available for a subset of patients, but for those people, it really can make a big difference.
So it's not the first go-to, but it is an option that's out there if it's needed.
Exactly correct.
And TMS, that's popular these days, certainly in the press. Talk about what TMS is, transcranial magnetic stimulation.
Right. TMS is, again, using using magnetism to stimulate the brain, results in certain currents within the brain, and has been shown in various studies to be effective for depression, and is certainly not invasive in the way that ECT mm-hmm. is invasive, mm-hmm. And has been shown in a number of studies to be effective. And okay. again, it's something that is on the list of potential treatment options for people.
You know, I think one of the things that's important to remind folks of is that every treatment option is not for everyone. So that if whatever it is, whatever treatment that you may be involved in, if for some reason you don't feel as though this is bringing about the results that you had hoped for, first thing is to talk to your prescribing physician, I would say, or clinician, and then to look for options. We've been talking about ECT, we've been talking about TMS, we've been talking about talk therapy, we've been talking about medication. There are all kinds of different options. I think the good news is that there are all kinds of different options that are available, and you really can, because you deserve it, I would suggest, do research and figure out what works best for you. Jeff, what would you say?
I agree with everything that you're saying, and we're not yet at a point where we can do a blood test or a brain scan and say, okay, for John Smith, this is the treatment that he needs.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not yet at that precision medicine, that individualized medicine based upon those types of laboratory tests. So while we know that, let's say, medication or talk therapy can be effective, we sometimes have to try one thing or the other until we get to the one that works best for the person. So an important message is be patient, don't give up,
mm-hmm.
because sometimes the first thing doesn't work, but for many people, we are able to find a combination, whether it be a particular medicine, sometimes more than one medicine, sometimes medicine combined with talk therapy.
Sure.
That really works for people.
Dr. Jeff Borenstein, CEO and President of the Brain and Behavior Research Foundation, Editor-in-Chief of Psychiatric News, the newspaper of the American Psychiatric Association, part of the editorial advisory group for the newly released Consumer Guide, Understanding Mental Disorders, Your Guide to the DSM-5. Thank you so much for joining us today. My guess is that we will have you back to talk about some more of the work that your foundation supports, because there's a lot of important work that is going on. But thank you for your time today.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
And folks, thank you for joining me on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications, and it is available to you on demand 24/7 by going to myndtalk.org, or you can simply go to iTunes and download the Mind Talk app. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, you can send an email to pamela@mindtalk.org. That is a confidential email address. Only I will see it. So again, that's pamela@myndtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, well, it's unacceptable. Take care.